It has been established the persons who have recently died have been returning to life and committing acts of murder.
Believe in ghosts?
First simply disappears, the other two died.
Pretties. It's your host, Ashley Lana, your certified nightmare prescriber, welcoming you back to another episode. How is everyone doing tonight?
We are great!
I am so glad to hear that, and thank you for responding to your device. This is what we solo podcasters do when we record in our own little booths. Like, we don't talk to people. So we record our opening conversations with ourselves, and then we hope that you, the listener, actually respond to our questions. And it's kind of like a podcasting Dora the Explorer, but not at all. So when I ask you questions involving true crime or even how are you doing this evening, I would love that you guys verbally respond out loud to whatever device you were listening on. Or in spirit, if you're introverted like I am. So, with that being said, welcome to Lullaby. Last episode, I announced that I was going to hit you guys with a 3 back-to-back worst of the worst episodes. And these are very dark cases. These episodes are graphic and they are not suitable for everyone if you're new to the show. My show actually has now developed into one giant disclaimer. I don't hide that. I go into detail about what happens within the crimes, not to glorify anything, but to explain the progression of how the killer's crimes or criminal's crimes progress over time. That's very important when you're trying to understand true crime cases. In the previous WoW episode, we examined the dark psychology of Bob Burdella, the Kansas City Butcher, and he was just a mess. Tonight, this case is absolute insanity that I had to break it into 2 parts. We are touching on a destructive cult, and here at the Fear Cult, we love cults. And it's a Canadian cult, bud. This is a Canadian cult from where I am up on the great Canadian North, eh? So, if you're listening and you have not found out by now, I'm Canadian, born and raised. So, I know this case very well, and I'm very excited to examine it with you. And if you don't know the case, then I'm even more excited because your jaw is going to hit your chest. There are 2 guest cameos, so when you hear them in the dramatization, think of who those voices might belong to. Here's a hint. They're podcasters. And the first cult we ever discussed was Reverend Jim Jones and the People's Temple of Jonestown. And I did that cult for a reason. And has it been done to death? Yes, obviously, of course it has. But that doesn't mean it's not relevant in history. When you understand cults and cult leaders, then you will understand how cults work, specifically destructive cults. Again, huge, huge note, there are destructive cults that are bad, and then there are just regular cults where nobody dies, nobody's getting beaten or tortured, and they're good, and they're actually peaceful. But the cult we are discussing tonight is not peaceful at all. As I said, it's a WoW episode. So if you have listened to the Jonestown episode, which was also a 2-parter, you'll recall me telling you to remember the techniques that Jim used to control the people. So when I did another cult episode, when you would hear a technique being used, you would think, oh, Jim Jones did that. And then you'll recognize destructive cults. And the cult leader that I'm doing tonight actually took notes from Jim Jones. He'd never met him. He never had any face-to-face interaction with him, but on his own, he monitored the guy. And the creature I am revealing tonight, in my perspective, is one of the most twisted and cruelest men to have ever walked the planet, making him a perfect worst of the worst episode. So get comfortable, because sweet dreams are made of these. The following following story contains subject matter involving graphic descriptions of physical and mental abuse, mutilation, crimes against children, and murder. Please take into consideration that some topics may be disturbing for some listeners. Listener discretion is advised. The child would not stop crying. Even after everything he had tried to do, it just continued to sob. The sound was now causing his blood to boil with rage. Grabbing his hair, he paced the room back and forth. Every other child was being quiet. What was wrong with this little demon tonight?
What the fuck?
Looking over, he pondered to himself just how long he could hang on before he completely lost his sanity.
Oh, shit.
That's when the child screamed even louder. Then, something inside of him snapped. Scavenging around the room, he found a thin sheet of cloth. He wrapped the small baby in the fabric and stormed out of the room. He made sure not to draw more attention from his followers, because he knew that what he was about to do was not going to be easy to lie about after. This is the horrific true story of Rock Theriault and his cult, the Anthill Kids. Rock Theriault was born on May 16, 1947, in the Rivière-du-Melon, Quebec, Canada. He was one of seven children to Hyacinthe Theriault, a house painter, and a homemaker named Pierrette Tremblay. Rock was raised in an extreme militant conservative French Catholic household. This caused Rock to grow a deep-rooted hatred towards the Catholic Church as he aged. In 1950, when Rock was 6 years old, the family moved to Thetford Mines, located in the Abitacour River in the Appalachian Mountains, south of Quebec City. The town was famous for its asbestos mining, and almost everyone in the community worked in the mines. The family was a part of the Pilgrims of St. Michael, also known as the White Berets. The group was a fascist Catholic sect that would march down the streets and go door to door begging for donations and new members. Other children in the community would mock and ridicule Rock for wearing the trademark white cap, and this only fueled Rock's hatred towards the Catholic Church. From an early age, Rock felt that he was superior to everyone else. He taught himself to speak English and loved to read books. Every one of Rock's siblings never went past the eighth grade, including Rock. Although an honors student, he decided to drop out in 1961. According to Rock, his father would abuse him, and he did not like the fact that his son was an academic. Rock claims that his parents abused him. It is not confirmed by anyone else in his family. Investigators conceived that he was embellishing a majority of the stories to seek attention, specifically from women. As later in life, we will see that he had multiple opportunities to move away from his abusive parents, but he chose to stay close. As Rock grew up, he utilized playing the victim to manipulate others around him. A former next-door neighbor of the family, up until the 1970s, named Léon Vachon, recalled the household having a somewhat abusive atmosphere, and at times saying, quote, "When Rock was a teenager, he and his three brothers would play a game called Bone. It was played with their father. They would sit at the kitchen table with heavy boots on and kick each other in the shins until one of them gave in." Léon then continued, saying, quote, "The mother was no better. You could hear her screaming at the kids from three quarters of a mile down the road, like no other person could scream." Rock's parents denied beating their son, and the other siblings supported this defense. The only punishment the children got was due to them misbehaving and lying. Rock claims that his father specifically was an aggressive alcoholic, while neighbors, friends, and family all deny that he ever was. As a 90s kid, and I'm sure previous generations can back me on this, but didn't you have some pretty sadistic childhood games? Because now, okay, my parents never did anything like the game Bone with me, and I'm not supporting any form of child abuse here, so calm down. When it comes to painful childhood games, at school, I can actually recall playing Bruise Pinch. Now, This is where you would run up behind your friends and you would grab the skin underneath their triceps, pinch, and pull down. And then the pain would make you just fall to the ground. And then you would have these bruises just lined up underneath your tricep. And the more you had, the tougher you were. It was a status symbol. Yeah, I don't know why the fuck we played that. That was a painful game. And we never stopped doing it. And then when we got told to stop by the teachers, yeah, we just did it outside on the lunch break. And then another one that we had was knuckle hockey. And all of my non-Canadian international listeners are like, what? Of course you would have something not related to hockey still refer to as hockey. So basically, this one would be where you would put your hands down on a table so that your knuckles were like the target or the net, so to speak. And then people would take turns slamming a coin into your knuckles until you couldn't handle it anymore. Knuckle hockey. We would even have playoffs, and it resulted in scabbed up hands, and it was gross. And now that I'm older and more mature, looking back on this, what were we thinking? That's all we had, though, in the 90s. We just had stuff like this. So when it comes to the game Bone, it kind of reminded me of those games. Now, no one in the family said they were forced to play the game with their father, and it was just a game that they played for fun. So the statement of Rock's mother being heard screaming at her kids, this kind of doesn't surprise me, and here's why. The woman had 8 kids, so you better believe she knew how to survive in that household, and so she learned how to roar. But let's assume that what Rock said about his parents being abusive is true. None of the other siblings said that they were abused, and the parents were just strict. So in the autobiography that Rock published, he painted these crazy stories of how his parents abused him. He would tell people and people would feel sorry for him. And then he would make up stories to make him seem like this savior of God and how he was so special. Jim Jones, anyone? Very Jim Jones. Now, the stories that Rock would say. So he claimed that he could talk to trees and even animals. And then in 1999, this is by far my favorite story, okay? So in 1999, while Rock was in prison, spoiler alert, he goes to prison. So he told a psychiatrist in Toronto by the name of Andrew Malcolm that when he was a child... Okay, give me a minute. This is just preposterous. Rock said that he came face to face with a mother bear and her 2 cubs when he was a child. And then this idyllic day, he was treated like one of the mother bear's own cubs. And he spent the day being rolled around, and she played with him the same way that she rolled her cubs. Bullshit! So, as a born and raised Canadian, settled between the Canadian Rockies, I am willing to bet my life that this did not happen. Sorry, Rock, you are not the great white North Tarzan. And if he claims to have come, quote, face to face with a mother bear and her cubs, he would have been swatted across the pond by that mother bear's paw, and he wouldn't have seen the light of day. Bears, when they're startled, especially when they're with their cubs, you get the fuck out of there, bud. Like, you're screwed. If you startle a bear, this is why when you're hiking, you're supposed to make noise, you're supposed to go in groups and play music and talk loud, so you don't startle the bears and they'll just walk away. But if he came face to face with a mother bear and her cubs, boy, you are done. I'm sorry. The lie detector test determined that that was a lie. And to second my point, once Rock was arrested much later in life, he was a confirmed pathological liar, and he would manipulate others into believing that he was a holy man and that he was always the victim in society. Cult leader 101, lie or die. So another lie that he told to make himself seem like a god was that he had the ability to castrate animals without doing anything, with no blood involved. So when it comes to pathological lying and cult leaders, a trait that they all have in common is that they're all pathological narcissists. They have this inflated self-esteem that makes them think that they are superior to everyone on the planet. And they use this confidence to successfully lie to vulnerable people, and they believe them. Now, because successful cult leaders are more often than not highly intelligent, they know when and how to pull an individual in with grandiose lies. They know who not to fuck with and who is the perfect target. The one lie that he would use to bring in his first four followers played on their belief in religion. And that was that he was the only true messenger of God, and he knew the exact date of the apocalypse because he was in direct contact with God. Now, since the Seventh-day Adventists, which we will get to, already believe that the end will come in their religion and they prepare for it, Rock eventually pulls vulnerable people aside and says, "I know exactly when this is going to happen. God tells me all the time. And if you're with me, you're going to be safe. But if you're not with me, then you're going to die. And as a messenger of God, I do not want that. So you should follow me." So let's continue. In 1965, 18-year-old Rock denounced his Catholic faith completely and expressed that he was going to find his own path in life. He built a house by hand close to his parents' house, which was another pondering inquiry regarding, did he really hate his parents for abusing him if he chose to live so close to home? He did claim that his parents kicked him out at 14 years old, but that was never confirmed. During this time, he was spending most of his days working and going to the local dance halls. Rock soon realized that he was popular with the ladies for the fact that he was a charmer, and that he also paraded that he was impressively well-endowed sexually. Although the concept of ideal penis size is subjective, to Rock, he felt that he was superior. Whenever Rock was in the public eye, he was always flashing his genitalia around, specifically to the ladies. The spotlight always fell on him, and he was the life of the party, and every woman fell to his knees, wanting a chance to be with the confident man. Rock soon realized that he had the ability to manipulate people with his high intelligence and glamorized stories. The more embellished the story was, the more people viewed him as special. It was then his ego needed to be constantly fed by others. In 1967, the Playboy met 17-year-old Francine Granier, and the couple had two boys, Rock Sullivan, born January 1969, and Francois, born April 1971. Also in 1971, Rock had begun developing painful gut problems. He was diagnosed with dumping syndrome. This is a condition that involves the stomach emptying its contents into the first section of the small intestine faster than normal. It is also known as rapid gastric emptying. Rock underwent two surgeries. The surgeries ended up turning Rock into a prolific hypochondriac, believing that his body was now filled with plastic. He would then tell everyone that he was highly susceptible to deadly cancer, and that this would happen very soon. It caused women to feel maternal and wanted to comfort him. Rock loved this so much that his mindset changed from being monogamous with his wife to declaring himself to being allowed to sleep with any woman he wanted to. Rock, Francine, and his two sons moved back to Rock's parents' house on the land, and he asked his parents if he could start a carpentry company. This is where he would craft homemade beer mugs and small furniture. The business ultimately failed. In 1974, his wife Francine grew sick of her husband, and the fights began. This spiraled Rock into abusing alcohol. One night in 1976, Rock met his soon-to-be new wife, 24-year-old Giselle LaFrance, in Quebec City. The two met while at a dance hall. He seduced her by claiming that his wife was cheating on him because he was dying of cancer, which of course was a lie. The victim card yet again worked, and the two began secretly dating, even though Rock was still married. Rock then divorced Francine. Giselle came from an abusive home where her father controlled the women. He even told her that his marriage to her mother was awful, and that if she wanted to be a good wife, then she would obey every order her future husband would give her. In an attempt to try and please her husband, she consumed so much alcohol that it dangerously burned away her intestines. She was forced to stop, but Rock never did. Rock and Giselle decided to rent an apartment in town, which Giselle was paying for. She grew concerned with Rock's alcoholism and his new obsession with religion, the Seventh-day Adventists specifically. In January 1977, Rock joined the local Seventh-day Adventist church in Thetford Mines. He got a taste for the feeling of being a prophet, and loved it. A hot topic during this time frame was the Jonestown cult. Brock had been following the Jim Jones story for years, and he even told people he knew that one day Jim Jones would bring upon a massacre to his people. He secretly idolized Jim Jones, his charisma, his manipulation, and his ability to draw everyone in. Deep down, what Brock was doing was taking notes. Overall, Brock's general interest in the Seventh-day Adventist Church is genuine, and it was because he believed in the same things that they did, such as eating only natural whole foods, a straight-edge lifestyle with no drinking or smoking, and Brock, although he was an alcoholic, he does stop for a bit. And later on, yeah, he fell off that horse and he fell on his ass hard. The church's pastor, Pastor Zita, he accepted Brock because he was unbelievably charismatic and he appealed to the church's membership. Pastor Zita, he had put Brock in charge of leading an anti-smoking clinic. But soon all Brock wanted was to lead a religious sect by himself that was built on the fundamentals of the Seventh-day Adventist, such as the holistic foods and the clean, healthy lifestyles. Throughout the 60s and the 70s, the Peace and Love movement was all about spiritualism and exploration, and many of the people, young people specifically, were searching for a significance in life. And this is where a lot of cult leaders in that time frame really were, I hate to use the word, successful, because they knew young people were looking for a path in life. And if it involves spiritualism, it really appealed to the hippie lifestyle. And Brock Terrio would utilize the conversion experience, which is the first introduction to a new group. And he would give them, with all his charisma and confidence, this overwhelming feeling of euphoria and community for having a purpose. So once that feeling is recognized by an individual, they feel that that is the feeling they have been missing, and that's the feeling that they need, and only this person, Brock Terrio, could give them, because he gave it to them, and they've been searching for it for such a long time. And Jim Jones did the exact same thing. Once the cult gets to a point where there's a bigger membership, then the leader, just like a succubus, just wants all the attention, but wants to see people fight over them for that feeling, to get that feeling back. So the leader will purposely abuse or abandon their members so they come crawling back to have that feeling of I'm important again. So Rock is involved in all these little membership drives and donations for the Seventh-day Adventists. And while going door to door preaching the word of God, he began telling people that he himself had met God and that he had experienced the truth. And now this kind of made older people go, yeah, okay, whatever, and the door got slammed. But to the younger, more gullible generation who was looking for a path in life, they believed him. And this attracted the younger generations to the church, which initially the church was like, this is fantastic. But we will see the church starts to go, okay, this is a little suspicious. Rock, what are you doing behind closed doors? And soon the church became uncomfortable with the specific individuals that Rock was initiating, whom he had been referring to as his disciples. In 1977, Pastor Zita recruited four young adults into the Seventh-day Adventists. They would quickly become hypnotized by Brock Terrio. The first four were 21-year-old Solange Ballon, 18-year-old Chantal LaFrance, 18-year-old Francine Laflemme, and a young man named Jacques Fissé. In the beginning, Brock mesmerized the four new members of the Adventist Church with his end-of-times conversations. They believed Brock was the Messiah, and Brock knew that they were easily manipulated. So he invited them to private sessions at Giselle's rented apartment. It did not take long for Brock to convince his girlfriend Giselle to let the four live at the apartment full-time, isolating them from the church. Brock was able to convert more people into his beliefs by giving them a sense of significance in their lives by following him. It is also important to note that he is currently the only member of the group that can speak English. Not too long after, Brock initiated 24-year-old Claude Ouellette, 20-year-old Nicole Roule, 20-year-old José Pelletier, and his friend, 18-year-old Maurice. Although some of his followers were still living with their parents, Brock had the others cram into his girlfriend's small apartment. He started having his disciples address him as Papi. the late summer of 1977, a beautiful young woman in her mid-20s considered herself to be a lost soul. She would soon find her way into the spell of the cult. Gabrielle Lavallée grew up in an abusive home, and thereafter, an abusive orphanage. When she graduated high school, she knew that she wanted to help people. Gabrielle became a registered nurse and learned how to speak English, and she started working at a local hospital. However, she was fired for killing a patient after administering the incorrect medication. Gabrielle felt depressed, as though she had no true path in life. She felt weak and vulnerable, and she said, quote, "I was deeply handicapped. I was sexually abused when I was very young, a trauma too hard to handle for my age, so I totally obliterated it from my memory. But still, the damage was done." Gabrielle, being an educated nurse, would later be manipulated by Rock, utilized as an associate for his health food store. Rock told Gabrielle that this was a way for her to feel useful and fulfilled, and to follow him. Gabrielle expressed in sadness how she felt that everything she had come in contact with at this point had failed. She herself felt lonely, sad, and depressed. She almost wanted to end her life, until she found purpose with meeting Rock Therio. Gabrielle did not want to give up. Gabrielle had decided to go to a Seventh-day Adventist anti-smoking retreat in Lake Rousseau, Quebec. After seeing Rock give a speech detailing how he was in personal communication with God, she had to be introduced to him. She said, quote, "I felt someone looking at me in such a way that I had a feeling he was seeing through me I'd never felt before. When his hands touched mine, they burned." Rock understood the importance of having a nurse at the helm of his holistic lifestyle. He himself was a hypochondriac, and he knew that by having Gabrielle push a clean living angle, he would draw more followers in, and, in result, money. Together, the small group would sell holistic meals at food stands to bring in money for the church. In September of 1977, Rock initiated a married couple, 24-year-old Jacques Chiguer, and his wife, 23-year-old Maryse Grenier. The couple had a 6-month-old daughter. Maryse joined because of her husband. She expressed that she did not enjoy living with Rock or the group because she did not fall for his lies. She stayed because of her love for her husband, and this is something that Rock knew, and he would manipulate others into using later. During a hike, Rock abruptly stopped and told the group not to follow him, for the Lord must speak with him. He climbed to an outpost and waited. When he returned, he told his followers that a bright white vision had appeared, and that his group were the chosen ones, and they could be saved from the inevitable apocalypse, but only if they stayed with him. This made most of the followers sell all of their belongings to join Rock permanently, and gave them all the money to support their cause. In October of that same year, Rock moved the group to Sainte-Marie. He made his 8 followers dress in simple uniforms with belted tunics. This was to reform their individuality. Rock gave himself a tunic robe that was brown, and this was to stand out, distinguishing himself as the leader. Member Francine Laflamme's glasses were destroyed by Rock. He claimed his way of life would bring her eyes back to perfect vision. Of course, it was only a way to make her more vulnerable. Pastor Zita from the Adventist Church became concerned about Rock's group, and he even tried speaking with the women and their parents, but to no avail. Rock's group opened up a holistic storefront called Clinique Vivere en Santé, meaning healthy food clinic. The group sold homemade baked goods, preservatives, and meals. The main purpose of the clinic was to provide alternative medicine that Rock claimed could cure any ailment with cash up front and no refunds. The stock of the store was supplied by the Adventist Church. Rock was embezzling from the store, and he had full control over the finances and the belief system of the group. The store was very successful, and more people wanted to join the group. With this, caused Rock to have more paranoia. He was aware that the more people who joined his group, the more opinions he would have to argue with. To prevent this, Rock told his followers that he had been having reoccurring visions and dreams of God himself warning him that the apocalypse was getting closer than ever, and that they had to be ready for a move in the near future. On December 11th, the concerned parents of Rock's followers went to the police to have him arrested. They demanded that Rock go through psychiatric evaluation in Quebec City. He was quickly taken into custody and brought for testing. Initially, the psychiatrist assumed that Rock may have suffered from schizophrenia. Of course, Rock was able to intellectually charm the doctor, which resulted in Rock getting a perfect, clean evaluation of mental health. Giselle, Brock's girlfriend, was becoming increasingly more jealous of the other women in the group. Brock was constantly flirting and touching the other women, and Giselle's insecurities increased. She demanded that her and Brock get married, since she was supposedly the only one that he was sleeping with. The couple got married on January 8, 1978. This next event shows the cruelty Brock Theriault was capable of. On the ride home from the wedding, Brock sat in the cab of the heated truck with two of the female flirtatious followers, while he forced his new wife Giselle to lay on a mattress in the back of the truck bed alone. But nothing changed after the wedding. Now, seemingly trapped, she tried harder to win her husband back. Giselle became pregnant soon after, and when Brock's flirtatious behavior with the other women didn't stop, Giselle expressed that she was going to leave him. Brock responded by punching her in the face, smashing her to the floor, and grounding her to her bedroom for 2 days. He then proceeded to lecture all of the women that in the Bible it states that women are to obey men and that he was their only path to God. Follow the Bible and follow him, and they would reach the Holy Land when the apocalypse came in the future. The parents of the followers could not understand how the relatives were still believing the preposterous philosophies of Brock Theriault. One notable event that occurred was when Brock went to the house of follower 19-year-old Chantal Labrière. He went to introduce his ideologies to her parents. Chantal's parents knew that their daughter was highly impressionable and would fall for almost anything. Brock attempted to explain his intentions with the group and the end of the world. The parents were then suspicious. He appeared to create bizarre claims that, when questioned, if he did not know how to answer them, he would fall to his knees and begin chanting as if he were speaking to God. Chantal's parents specifically requested a psychiatric evaluation for their daughter, as well as Brock. Initially on March 18th, the Quebec authorities descended on Brock's group with a court order for Chantal Labrière, but they were refused entry by Brock. 2 months later, Brock was interviewed on a local radio station, where he discussed his prophecies. The police raided the cult's small home to enforce the court order regarding Chantal Labrière, who they forcibly escorted to the hospital for a psychiatric evaluation. Brock Theriault was brought in for trial charges on obstructing of justice. Brock was found guilty and was given a suspended sentence. Chantal went through a 4-week mental evaluation and she was declared healthy. Once she was released, she went back to live with the group. Brock was given another evaluation, and of course, he manipulated and lied, and therefore he passed. In March of 1978, a leukemia patient named Geraldine Auclair joined the Healthy Living Clinic after her husband wanted to join. Brock told the couple that it was God's plan to have Geraldine stop going to the hospital for medical treatments and to stay with the group. He was going to use whole foods and grape juice to cure her. Weeks passed, and Geraldine died. Brock told his followers that after she had died, he had kissed her corpse, and this made her open her eyes and come back to life for a moment. But because he had kissed her, he had allowed God to take her into the Holy Land. Growing suspicious, Pastor Zita and the public heard about the terrible news of Geraldine's passing, and they expelled Brock Theriault from the Seventh-day Adventist Church. The church had been their health clinic supplier for healthy food and missionary supplies. Now that was all gone. The police had placed Brock under surveillance due to the death of Geraldine. The group was now under the radar, and their leader had begun to sweat. Brock decided that he would marry his followers together to please the former church and decrease the odds of the followers wanting to leave the cult. If one did not want to go, then the other would probably want to stay, just like Jacques and Maryse. Brock understood that if he planned to keep his cult together, he would have to isolate his 20 members from the outside world. He started to bring up the prophesied apocalypse and said that the official day of reckoning was February 17th, 1979. He proclaimed that boulder-sized hailstorms would come, followed with earthquakes and lightning, and kill everyone on Earth. With fear invoked in the group, he said that he could save them, but only if they stayed with him when he and Giselle moved to the acquired plot of landlocked forest in the Gaspé Peninsula, where he could isolate his group from the devils and sinners of the world. Together, Brock and his followers hiked on foot for 2 days into the woods to the foot of a hill. Brock declared the hill Eternal Mountain. He then changed the group's name to the Holy Moses Mountain Family, and they were to address him only as Moses. Every follower was then given a new name to christen their new life at this new location that was 4 hours walking distance from any civilization. While sleeping in tents at night, Rock had his entire group spend 17 hours a day to build the log cabin that they planned on living in. Rock, of course, had no hand in the labor. He sat around dictating orders while complaining about stomach pains. They had to build the cabin quick, because the winters arrived fast and unannounced in the area. Everyone was tired, and when somebody complained about being hungry, Rock would decrease their current rations, limiting their food to keep them weak, and keeping them working to keep them distracted. This put the 20 followers in a zombie-like state. Gabrielle told the media that they had no time to think about what was happening around them due to being preoccupied. The group was only eating raw vegetables that they grew on the land, and this was not enough to keep them well nourished. Brock, of course, was eating very well. He started drinking alcohol again and abandoning all the Seventh-day Adventist holistic views. He did not let his members join in the same lifestyle. He told them that he was superior to them because he was to lead them to the Holy Land. Brock would set up a competition-like mindset in his followers. He would split his followers into two groups, the favored and the not. Brock would choose a woman to favor for a week, and in that turn would cause a competitive jealousy amongst the others. The women would then do whatever they could to catch Brock's attention. He enjoyed using the technique of religious confession to build strong bonds with his followers. He would sit them down individually, and with each member, he would have them confess their darkest secrets. Little did the followers understand that he was doing this to use it against them in the future. If they complained or got an attitude, he would punish them. And soon, the punishments would become far more physical and deadlier than they could ever imagine. One event occurred when his pregnant wife Giselle expressed to Rock that many of the followers felt lonely, because although Rock declared the commune marriages between the rest of the followers, they were not happy. Rock saw this as an opportunity to psychologically hurt Giselle and as a way to sleep with all of the other women. Rock announced that Giselle had this great idea that since they were all lonely, that he would have sex with all of the women and begin relationships with everyone. This, of course, upset his wife Giselle on another level. He was manipulating her words. The reason she wanted to marry him months prior was to separate the fact that she was the only one at the time having sex with Rock. When Giselle confronted Rock, he threw her to the ground and began choking her. He screamed that women obey men and he was the messenger of God. Nobody would question him. A former member explained how the group was able to tell the appropriate time to talk to Rock was by the weather. If the sun was shining and the birds were singing, he was in a joyous mood. But when the weather was dark and rainy, he would drink and become unstable. Gabrielle Lavallée described the divide, saying, quote, "I was in the second group. We had no rights to say anything, to be against anything. We are to accept what is going on no matter what. And if you don't accept, you are to be punished." Cult expert Mike Coltfield explained the dynamic shift when a group is isolated from the daily social norms and they are controlled by a leader. The governing changes from democracy to a radical totalitarian control. Like Gabrielle explained, there is zero opposition, or you would be punished. However, at this point, Rock did not argue if a follower wanted to leave. He would only warn them that if they left, they would no longer be saved during the end of times. The consistent oppressive rules, malnourishment, and consistent labor made two of the members, Yolande and Leo, express that they needed to leave because they did not belong. Rock did nothing to stop them. He just informed them that if they left, they would become demons and sinners like the rest of the world. When the cabin was completed, it consisted of only a single open room with a well in the center for water. The sheets were hung up as dividers, and with the collection of the followers' welfare checks, they had a monthly budget of $1,400. Every night, Rock would give sermons, and due to his alcoholism, if anyone fell asleep, adult or child, he would use a wooden stake or club to beat them until they learned their lesson and were bleeding. On November 18, 1978, the news of the horrific Jonestown massacre spread across the world. The fear of destructive cults was put on alert worldwide. If you go back to episode 6 of Lullaby, we cover the Jonestown Massacre and the People's Temple. The families and friends of Brock's followers became even more concerned and demanded that the authorities arrest Brock Therio. The police then had the Holy Mountain cult undergo psychiatric evaluations again. Brock convinced the doctors that his spiritual mountain group was not a cult, and that the racist English-speaking Canadians were demanding this out of the hate for the Francophones. Brock also went on to lie to say that there was no leader in the group and everyone lived in a democracy. There was no polygamy and there was no abuse. At the end of the evaluation, the head of the psychiatric department ordered a news media conference to tell the world that Brock was a spiritual genius, a man of God. They also went on to say that they believed that the police should be ashamed of themselves for submitting him and his group to this form of harassment, saying that Rock Thério had, quote, "He has an intelligence that is much higher than average. He is a Renaissance man with a bright, inquisitive, and sensitive nature." In the documentary Very Bad Men, investigative journalists explain how the entire staff believed every word Rock had to say, and they even sent a 23-year-old mental patient by the name of Guy Vier to live with him and his followers so Brock could heal him. Guy was forced to live in a shed, and he was given hard manual labor as well as the duty of taking care of the children. This would be a fatal mistake. Once the Holy Mountain family was psychologically cleared to continue, Brock's lust for power only grew. Brock wanted to get every woman in his commune pregnant to grow a spiritual congregation, and only after a couple months, all of the women were pregnant. When he would bring a woman to his bed, he would grab their hand and make them grab his large penis. He would then declare that God would only give a true Messiah this gift. He would then forcefully shove their heads into his groin to start the intercourse. For sick, twisted entertainment, and as a way to create a competition for his admiration, Rock would have the women strip completely naked and have them physically fight each other inside of a circle to see who would win. Whoever won got his attention for that night. Brock would score the punches and injuries to dictate who would win. Violence soon became Brock's main source of aggressive control. His followers would get beaten with rods and wooden clubs until they were bloody if they did not listen to him. For one petty example, follower Maurice, who was pregnant, ate 2 pancakes without being given permission, and Brock intentionally broke her ribs while beating her. Brock didn't particularly enjoy children. He only seen them necessary as a way to grow his followers. He used the children as a way to control the women. The children and the babies that were not Rock's flesh and blood were to be treated like animals, like dirt, and to be punished harder and more violently. Rock demanded that every member, including the parents of the child, to treat them the same way, or they would be punished. After, he would make them write an apology letter that he would read aloud as humiliation. Warning: the following contains graphic content and abuse towards children. Listener discretion is advised. The children were all forced to sleep away from their parents. Children and babies who were not related to the Rock were forced to sleep out in the cold shed outside. If any of them or the parents were to raise a fuss, then they were to be abused. For example, when a 6-month-old baby started crying, Rock forced its mother, Maurice, to strip the child naked and take it outside. Once in the freezing temperatures, she was to roll the baby in the snow until its skin was blue and bordering hypothermia. This was not a one-time abuse on Maurice and her baby. The child's father, Jacques, was too scared to disobey his leader. In the past, whenever a member wanted to leave the cult, Brock would just let them go, but tell everyone how they were sinners and were joining the damned. This, however, changed for the worse. When Maurice got fed up with the torture she was forced to inflict on her child, she was thinking of leaving. And when Brock found out, he forced her husband, Jacques, to cut off one of her toes with an axe in front of the commune. One night, when Guy was taking care of the children, a baby started crying. After attempting to calm the child, he got frustrated and began shaking and beating the baby. Soon, the infant fell into a coma. When Brock discovered what had happened to the baby, he thought it was the best thing to circumcise the child. Brock truly believed that he was a godlike being and decided that he would take on the task himself of performing the surgery on the boy. Gabriel recalled, quote, "He really believed that he was gifted, and God gave him a gift to perform operations, to do surgeries. But when Rock played doctor, he was Frankenstein." Lying baby Samuel on the kitchen table of the cabin, Rock poured a large quantity of 100% ethanol as an anesthetic down the child's throat using a rubber bulb. Rock began attempting his surgery using a razor blade. In the end, 2-year-old Samuel died, but not from the surgery. He died from alcohol poisoning. Rock was able to convince every one of his followers that if Guy had not punched the child in the face, the child would not have needed surgery. Therefore, would not have died. He then had all of his followers hold a mock legal trial in their cabin for Guy. The group declared Guy guilty but mentally unstable, and thus, they agreed castration was the suitable punishment. Rock was able to convince Guy that the only way to fix his problems, including his anger, his chronic headaches, and being addicted to masturbating, was to castrate him and remove his right testicle. Just like two-year-old Samuel, Rock made Guy lie on the kitchen counter, and he ended up removing both of his testicles, leaving only the scrotum. He kept the testicles in a napkin and left Guy to face his new mutilation. Days had passed and Guy was being mentally and physically abused by Rock. Guy ended up fleeing the compound and telling the authorities of the atrocities that were happening at the cabin. Rock was arrested for criminal negligence with what he had done to the poor baby Samuel and the mental patient Guy. He was then sent to jail for 14 months, and the group Rock created was ordered by the judge to disband. While Rock was in prison, some members knew that they should no longer be involved with the group, so they left. Others wanted to keep the group alive, so they stayed. Rock would phone them from jail and reassure the standing members that they were special and destined for a new path once he was out. The phone bill ran up to $500 a month. He convinced his remaining followers that they would not be doing any heinous acts, and peace was the only true way to salvation. The group believed that their Messiah truly wanted to build a better life for them. All of the silver words sunk deep into their minds, so they waited for him. In February of 1984, Rock was released from prison, and on May 2nd of that same year, he moved the group west of Ontario, Canada, to a remote area of forest north of Toronto, close to Burnt River. Although Rock promised a new beginning, he had no intention of changing his malicious ways. He, in fact, had plans of making everything worse. The group was now moved to a more desolate location that was landlocked by trees. Again, Rock had his followers build another cabin, and at this point, Rock changed his name of his group from the Holy Moses Mountain Family to the Ant Hill Kids because of his followers' quote, ant-like hard work. Gabrielle Lavallée conceived two children with Rock. According to Gabrielle, what he did to her was far worse than any pain she would suffer later. Rock separated her from her children, and he had his favored wives in the first group raise her babies. She recalled in an interview titled The Deadly Messiah that not being able to love her children destroyed her. The only thing that kept her going was the prospect of maybe being able to be their mother one day, and the strength of God gave her to not leave. On the freezing night of January 26, 1985, with the Canadian winter temperatures exceeding negative 20 degrees Celsius or negative 4 degrees Fahrenheit, not including wind chill, the group was inside working away when Rock could not stop one of Gabrielle's babies from crying. Rock then grabbed the 5-month-old infant and wrapped it in the thin fabric, taking it outside. He placed the baby inside of a wheelbarrow as punishment for hours. Later that evening, when Rock went to go check on the baby, he discovered that it had died. Rock had told Gabrielle that the child had died of crib death syndrome, more commonly known as sudden infant death syndrome. Gabrielle believed what Rock had told her, since he had told the authorities the same story, that the child had died of SIDS. Many articles claim that Gabrielle was the one who left her child in the wheelbarrow that night. On the documentary, Very Bad Men, it was confirmed that it was not Gabrielle, it was Rock Therio. Rock fathered multiple children with the women. If a child overall was well-behaved, then when he would punish them, it would seem less severe by his standards. He would take a child, hold it up against a tree, and using knives or stakes, he would hammer the child's clothes into the tree trunk so they could not run. Rock would then demand that the mother of the child would throw stones at their kid until he deemed the punishment enough. If anyone argued, then he would threaten to punish the child in a worse way, and the physical brutality and mutilation had only just started. Rock initially segregated his people away from society to shield them from unwanted attention. Of course, compounding yourself and a dozen others away in the woods can do the opposite. An investigative journalist by the name of Devi Villica was given the task to track down Rock's mysterious group and investigate their odd behavior. Debbie recalled how there was no maps to the property, and not many people knew the exact route to get to the dense wilderness to find the acreage. Debbie parked alongside the paved road and exited the car. Standing on the remote highway along a bush line, she observed her surroundings. After walking in the forest for what seemed like an hour, a piece of bark flew off a nearby tree. Debbie flinched and stopped. More gunshots rang out as she ducked for cover. The gunfire never ceased, and without a second thought, Debbie crouched and hurried from the area back to her vehicle. This was not the kind, polite, and non-aggressive Christian group that the media had portrayed. Something was definitely not right. But now, this made her even more curious. A few days later, Debbie returned with another journalist, and they rented an off-road truck to drive straight to the compound. Night had fallen by the time they reached the acreage settlement. The truck came to a stop, and Debbie had seen two women rush up to the vehicle as she got out.
Hey, what are you doing here?
My name is Debbie, and I am a journalist. I work for the Finland Falls Gazette.
I don't know what that is.
That is a newspaper. And I am just here with my co-worker to meet and ask you and Rock Therio some questions about this settlement that you have clearly worked very hard to have.
No one was expecting visitors, so it's in your best interest to leave. Now.
I just have some questions.
Then maybe you should have planned ahead rather than showing up unannounced.
It won't take long. They are quick and simple, but the longer we stand here, the longer this will take.
Rock won't be happy that you just showed up here and expect everyone to stop what they're doing to answer your quick and simple questions.
We drove all day and now we are here. And with all due respect, I am not leaving until I meet with Mr. Therio.
Follow me.
The woman was clearly annoyed as she led the two reporters into the home. As they entered the dining area, Debbie was met with a table of 12 young children. The room was silent and no one was moving. The two journalists took a seat and sat there in silence. Moments later, Rock entered through a doorway with a grandiose entrance, and he strided over and pulled out a chair and took a seat.
Told that you are reporters, you'd ask me some questions. I must admit, I was not prepared for such an encounter.
Yes, I do realize that we are unannounced, and I do apologize. Your group, however, is very hard to get in contact with, and I just wanted to clear up any mysteries about this little community that you have created.
The waters are muddy from people drinking and walking through it, but by you coming to the source of the river, the water is clean. And by coming to the source, you've come to me. And so, you have come to the truth.
The entire time Rock had spoken to Debbie, he was speaking in metaphors and riddles. The followers sat around mesmerized by the words flowing from their leader's lips. Debbie, however, was not as entranced.
Please answer a confusing question that I have. The wives. Why does one man need so many wives? 7 of them, to be exact.
They are not wives in the conventional sense. We are not married. The women love me, and I love them. They are my world, and I am their Messiah. This relationship is an agreement, and babies come. It is only natural.
That is an interesting perspective.
The world is an interesting place.
When the journalists left, they knew the information Rock had fed them was smoke and mirrors. Debbie and her co-worker were going to get down to the bottom of the dangerous cult, the Anthill Kids. Rock Therio would then spiral into a madness of power and sadism that would leave no cult member a void of. The body mutilation, bloodshed, and murder had just gotten started. Join me next week for the brutal final conclusion of Rock Therio and the Anthill Kids. A very special thank you to Megan and Steve from For the Booze Paranormal Podcast, available wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Are you a lover of the paranormal?
Do you find yourself asking,
is it real?
Well, listen in every Monday at 12 p.m. Eastern,
where we talk about all your favorite paranormal shows.
YouTube channels,
haunted locations, and much, much more.
Join us on For the Booze as we discuss the history and the mystery behind it all.
Available everywhere podcasts are found.